This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Everybody, you're listening to Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show. This is episode 34, and your hosts for today are me, Damien, and Glenn.
Hello!
Now, guys, I've got to be honest with you. Today's episode has been a complete and total nightmare to put together. We were originally going to record this with Andy, Glenn, and me. And unfortunately, we started off having a load of Skype internet problems. Skype just kept dropping the call. I think Andy's got an internet problem. We finally got it all working, and then the doorbell rang, and Andy's wife's midwife arrived, and he had to take hold of the baby. So Andy, unfortunately, has had to run out of this one due to other commitments. So Glenn and I are just going to ramble amongst ourselves to a sort of rough show plan for the next half an hour or so. And we hope you enjoy our sort of very much sort of off-the-cuff show. So anyway, in the true Retro Asylum format, we're going to first start by what the two of us have been up to. So Glenn, what have you been up to?
Well, what I've been up to, Damien, I've been on eBay and I found a game called Knights for the Sega Saturn.
Okay.
Now, it's one of these games on the Sega Saturn that it's been renowned to be brilliant. And I have never played it. So I thought, yeah, I get this game. And it was £5 from eBay.
Wow.
And I honestly think it's a really, really good game, Damien.
That's really interesting because we talked about this briefly before Andy had to go off, and Andy actually has said it's one of the classic Saturn games, and I've got to confess, my knowledge of the Sega Saturn is virtually zero. It's one of those consoles that, for me, I never experienced at all, and I know a lot about the Dreamcast, and I know a lot about the Mega Drive, but the Saturn is one console I know nothing about. And I think it's probably one of the things that caused Sega to sort of get out of business eventually, is they had so many consoles out at the same time that no one really knew which one to pick and which one to play. So I think the Saturn was out at the same time as the sort of the add-on for the Mega Drive, wasn't it?
Yeah, the 32X, Damien. And that was a miserable failure.
Well, I think there's just a lot of confusion over, you know, what do I buy? I've got this Mega Drive. It's a 32X. Is that like a Saturn? Is that the same thing? Can the games be played on both platforms? And they couldn't. It was all totally different platforms. And yet, you know, no one really knew what to do. And I think Sega would have done a lot better just to have discontinued the Mega Drive and released Saturn in its own right. And it probably would have been all right then. But alas, they didn't.
I think the problem is that with the Saturn, they noticed the PlayStation was coming out. And they panicked and brought the Saturn out really early. You know, they basically went to E3 that year, or the game show ever they had that year, and they said, "Oh, the Saturn's available right now." And people went, whoa, we only just heard about this console. So they just released the Saturn with Virtual Fighter 1, and Virtual Fighter 1 didn't exactly get good press.
No, it just didn't really work out for them at all. And of course, this isn't the first time that a machine has been rushed out. If you remember back to the old Amiga and Atari days, back in the 80s, originally the guys that were part of Amiga Inc., the people that came up with the original Amiga system, they originally did a deal with Atari, and Atari were going to release what was the Amiga's hardware. But unfortunately, Atari sort of tried to screw them over a little bit, and eventually they pulled out of the deal. And guess what? Commodore were waiting there to pick up the hardware and release it themselves, and that's exactly what happened. Of course, this left Atari in a position where they had no 16-bit computers, so they very quickly cobbled together the Atari ST out of off-the-shelf components and released it, you know, just before the Amiga did, in order to take away some of that 16-bit marketplace that the Amiga was going to get. And you know what? It worked just fine, didn't it?
It did. And you know what the funny thing was? Jack Tramiel, I don't know if I said that person's name right, he was the CEO of Commodore. He got sacked, And around that time, Warner Communications were having trouble with Atari because it had this American games crash. He bought Atari. And so that's how all this began.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think you did say Jack Tramiel, right? That's how I've always pronounced his name. But yeah, he literally jumped from Commodore to Atari. Because I think at Commodore, he fell out of favor with some of the shareholders and basically got pushed out. And he had enough money. And of course, I think Warner, as you say, had a lot of problems with their acquisition of Atari because of the video game crash. So I think he just picked up Atari for no money at all, really. And basically, I suspect he was probably a little bit upset with Commodore, and so would do anything he could to actually to get something out, get something over them, you know, really try and ruin them a bit, because obviously they kicked him out. So there we go, Jack Tramiel, head of two really, really important computer game companies.
Anyway, what have you been playing, Damien?
So, well, this week I've been playing a number of things. On my sort of very, very retro side, I've been playing Jet Set Willy 2, The Final Frontier again. Now, this is the version of the game that originally appeared on the Amstrad, and it was a sort of sequel to the original Jet Set Willy, but it wasn't really a sequel. It's kind of more of an upgrade. It's what you'd expect a sort of add-on pack that you might get for Doom or Quake would be like. And it had all the original Jet Set Willy rooms, but because the Amstrad CPC 464 had quite a little bit more memory than the 48K Spectrum, they suddenly decide, well, let's use all this memory to add some more rooms to Jet Set Willy. And that's exactly what they did. And a lot of the rooms that were added, they were to confirm rumours that circulated about the original Jet Set Willy game. Because in the original game, I don't know if you know this, Glenn, but in the original game, there are all sorts of things that you're supposed to be able to do. Like, you could take Willy into space by a rocket on the roof of his house. You could sail his yacht off to a desert island. Now, in the original game, these features just didn't exist. They weren't really there. It was sort of hearsay and rumour, and people used to try and find these rooms, but they just weren't there. But Jet Set Willy 2, the authors of that on the Amstrad decided, well, let's put those rooms in, and that's exactly what they did. So I've been playing through Jet Set Willy 2. I've been up, I've taken Willy up in the rocket to his space station. It's really good fun. When he does it, his character changes, a bit like when you go into Nightmare Room, he turns into a sort of little bee or something. Yeah. I'm not too sure what it's supposed to be. When you go into space, he actually turns into a little spaceman. You sort of wander around, and you can go into special screens. You go into a transport room, which I think is called Beam Me Down Snotty, slight reference to Star Trek there. And if you stand on a transport pad, it'll actually beam you into a sort of little planet, and it's got, you know, three or four little screens of this planet and stuff. You can explore that and collect the objects. And, you know, Jet Set Willy is probably one of the hardest games I've ever played. It's got all that sort of pixel-perfect jumping and stuff, and it's...
Oh, it has.
It's so hard, isn't it?
I do know. I remember playing it, and I think I only could get to, like, the second screen. I wasn't very good at it whatsoever.
No, I mean, it was a bit easier than Manic Miner, which I think Matt Smith actually did say that he had no real thought to the order in which he put the screens together in Manic Miner. And actually, the first screen, I think, is probably pretty much the hardest one in the game. I find that once I can get past that, I get onto, like, you know, screen 4 or 5. But Jet Set Willy wasn't quite that hard. But, you know, to try and complete the game, and the original version, the first version on the Spectrum, actually couldn't be completed because there were a few bugs in it. So the Amstrad version, they didn't make it any easier, but they actually did take the bugs away. And I'm telling you, Glenn, I was playing this with a cheat on, with, you know, infinite lives, no collision detection. It was still really, really hard. So I can't imagine what it was like without a cheat on.
Well, I have played this game, and, oh, it is hard. And I can't actually get past the first bit, like I said. Yeah.
I know, it's just incredible. I would love to know if anyone knows. Is there anyone out there that's actually completed Jet Set Willy 2? And I say without a cheat. Or maybe, you know, even if you complete it with a cheat, it must have taken you hours. But we'd love to hear from you. So, you know, drop something on the comments section for this podcast, or just write something on the forum, because it'd be great to hear if anyone has actually managed to do it, because I know I haven't. And Glenn, it sounds like you haven't either.
Oh, no. Well, they're probably either a liar or a legend. That's all I can say about that.
So that's my sort of very old retro game. The other thing I've been up to this week is, you've probably noticed by now, I've released another 8-Bit Wars video. So it's my first video for this month. I'm going to try and do one of these each month. And the problem with doing more than that is, as Andy said, it takes so long to edit. And in a similar way to this podcast, where we've had all sorts of technical problems, I was trying to record this 8-Bit Wars video last night, and it was a complete nightmare. Everything was just going wrong. I used Vegas to do my editing. I did all the recording using Fraps, which is a special video recorder for gaming. And first thing I did is I forgot, and I put all the games with this special scanline mode in, which looks lovely when you're playing them. But when you come to put it in the editor, it does really weird stuff with the video, and it just looks all shimmery and stuff. So I had to record all the game clips again. It was just such a horrible nightmare.
Do you emulate it?
Yes, I do. I mean, I play it on the original machines if I can, but when I actually go to record the 8-Bit Wars videos, I actually emulate it using WinApe and I think CCS64 and Speculator, the Spectrum emulator. The game I was playing was Who Dares Wins 2, which is the which is a Commando ripoff by Alligator Software. And as Andy was explaining, I knew a little bit this backstory, but actually at the time, the releases of Commando, which was Electronic Arts, they actually saw Who Dares Wins 2, which is very much a rip-off of Commando, and they tried to withdraw it from sale, basically. And the original game had to get revamped, so Who Dares Wins got withdrawn from sale. They changed some of the screens and stuff, and they released Who Dares Wins 2. And basically, it's pretty much the same game, only they had to change some screens so that the Electronic Arts guys didn't sue them. And so this game, it's a lot easier than Commando, I've got to say. It's very much similar. So if you play Commando, the arcade game, or any of the 8-bit ports, you're basically a little man and you have to make it from the bottom to the top of each level. And at the end of each level, there's an outpost. So essentially, you're fighting through these different screens, or on the Commodore version, it scrolls. On the Amstrad and Spectrum versions, it's static screens. And you basically go about three or four screens up to the top. You then get to a sort of little outpost at the end where you can't go any further. You just have to shoot all the men, basically. And once you've done that, you move into the next section. Now, this is one of the games that I've played, you know, quite a lot when I was young, and I used to be able to get quite a long way through it. And in fact, I actually managed to complete it the other day when I was playing it. I thought, oh wow, I've done really well. And then I found out some reviews, they said it's actually a really easy game to complete, so I don't feel quite so good now. Now, talking of announcements, Andy wanted us to talk about the Retro Revival show, which is shaping up, actually, from what I've been hearing, is going to be even bigger than Replay Expo. Now, Retro Revival, that's on the 18th to the 19th of May this year, of course. And Chris Wilkins, the show organiser, has been incredibly kind. He's actually given us 10 tickets to give away. And how Andy's going to give these tickets away is on every full episode of the Retro Asylum podcast, he's going to announce a challenge. And basically, the winners of that challenge who get... And the sort of challenges are going to be things like the fastest time to get through a certain level of Sonic the Hedgehog. And you're basically going to post up your times on the forum, and maybe with some evidence as well of what you've done, maybe a screenshot of what your score was or what your time was. And what he's going to do is the winners, two of the winners each week, they will win two of these tickets. So it'll be a different challenge each week. I know the first one's a Sonic one. I don't know what the other ones are going to be yet. But hey, it's a really good way of you guys getting hold of some free Replay Expo tickets. So many thanks to Chris Wilkins for doing that. And guys, get listening to the full episodes of the podcast, and I would get practicing on the games that will be the challenges.
What was the first game he mentioned? What about Sonic the Hedgehog? Get the best time on that.
That's right. So that's what he said. Unfortunately, my Skype call phased out at the time. But I think what he was saying is that basically it's to get the best. Was it to get the best time through the first level of Sonic the Hedgehog? Is that the idea?
Yeah, beat Andy's time for the first level, and the best time wins the tickets.
Ah, so okay, that makes sense now. So I think what Andy was saying is he's going to put on the forum his best time. And guys, really, what you've got to do is you see that best time for level one of Sonic the Hedgehog, and you see if you can beat it.
I think it'd be very hard because he was pretty good at Doritos Crash Course. But that's probably too modern to say on this podcast.
It's probably it. Well, I tell you what, Glenn, in 10 years' time, it'll probably be really, really old. And we'll be talking about, I don't know, Mutant Invaders 296 or Pac-Man 39 or something, which will be a fully virtual world and stuff. Who knows?
Hello, Mr. Sid here. If you're after some retro gaming goodness, then you have come to the right place. From the Speccy to the Sega Master System, Capcom to Codemasters, and Space Invaders to Space Harrier, it's all covered in the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum.
Now it's time for us to go on to our game review section, and we've got two games to review. And Glenn, you're going to go first, so tell me, what game are you reviewing today?
Well, I want to review a classical game, one of my favourite games as a kid, Sim City. Now, I remember playing this on the PC, and funny enough, I think it actually came with my PC.
Right.
It was one of those free games that are hidden away in the expensive computer. And what you do, you have this, like, map. And you have, like, roads, you have, like, police, you have, like, residential, you have commercial. And what you have to do, you have to build a successful city. Now, it's not just, like, clunky only buildings anywhere. You have to think about where you put down the buildings, because if you plunk two buildings too close together and make the road small, you're going to start having traffic congestion problems. And what else can happen? Disasters can happen in your city. Floods could come into your city and flood the houses. And you could also have, like an earthquake that could shake and destroy some of your roads and your power plants. And it's a way of introducing people into being a mayor of a city.
It's such an interesting idea, and I do remember this game when it came out. I think you said it came out in about 1989, is that correct?
Yeah, it came out in 1989. I mean, it came out on all sorts of platforms.
Because, do you know what? I think I remember seeing this game on the BBC Model B. Now, I might be wrong, but I've got a feeling that's when I first saw it. It may be a much earlier version, but I think I do remember seeing it on the BBC Model B. It may not have been SimCity, it might have been something similar, but I do have that memory. So I'll have to check later to see if that is the case. But I'm just wondering, Glenn, do you think that SimCity might have sort of made a load of aspiring mayors back in the day? Do you think some people who are now mayors today, do you think they played that game?
Well, if you play SimCity and you're a mayor in the future, we'll be having our cities run a lot better now.
Yeah, I'm wondering that. I wonder if there's any mayors out there that can tell us they played SimCity and that it's actually really improved their road sort of layout and stretch and all that sort of stuff.
What was funny, I think I saw a review once, a strange review on YouTube somewhere, that actually had Ken Livingstone reviewing SimCity 2000. Now, the thing is, you can't put the congestion charge down in SimCity 2000.
No, they should make an add-on patch for it. So, Glenn, the game I want to talk about is TimeSplitters 2, and it came out in 2002, so it's not quite as old as SimCity, but it was made by Free Radical Design, and it came out on the three major last generation console platforms. So we're talking our PlayStation 2s, our Xboxes, and our GameCube. And it was basically made by half of the original Rare Software Company, who were, of course, back in the day, Ultimate Play the Game. And basically, Rare split into two pieces. One part remained and joined Microsoft, and they're still called Rare to this day, but the other half became Free Radical Design, and they went on and they made TimeSplitters 2, they made the original TimeSplitters game as well, and TimeSplitters 3, and a whole load of other stuff, including Second Sight, I think, was another game they made. And what I really love about TimeSplitters 2 is it was when I bought my GameCube, so it was really just after I left university and got my first job, and I was still very, very poor, so I bought this GameCube, which... It's another thing we were talking about earlier, is actually the GameCube, when it came out, was really, really cheap.
It was £130, and I could believe it when I saw it released. £130, so I can see why you bought one, Damien.
No, it's amazing. I didn't remember that it was quite that cheap, but Glenn and I were talking to Andy about this earlier, and Glenn said, you know, he remembered it was £130, and Andy's like, no, that can't be right, because I'm sure I spent more than that, and we just... Sorry, Andy, we've just looked it up on the internet, and it's absolutely true. £130, isn't that amazing for a console?
I know. Well, I don't think even the PS3 ever went down to that. I believe the Xbox 360 did for a bit, but then went back up again.
So they keep doing different things with the Xbox. They sort of sell it off cheap, and they put no storage with it, or they then have a slightly dearer version with lots of storage. It's all fluctuating all the time. Anyway, to get back to talk about TimeSplitters 2, I was quite poor, so I bought this console, and I used to live in a shared house, and I had lots of mates that I lived with, people I'd been to university with, and like the N64, the GameCube was one of those consoles where you could plug four different controllers in, so you could literally, like on the N64 with GoldenEye, you could split the screen four ways and you can have four players going. Let me tell you, Glenn, on a 14-inch screen, you've got a very, very small playing area. It's kind of very, you have to sit very close to see what you're doing, but that's what we used to do all the time. And TimeSplitters 2, it's very much like GoldenEye in a way. It hasn't got the sort of ties to James Bond franchise, so they've aimed to be a lot more imaginative with how the game works. But a lot of the level design, it's a little bit, it has been criticised in the past for being a little bit too bitty. So whereas GoldenEye's got a definite sort of plot going through it, TimeSplitters sort of does, but the way it revolves around different characters popping into different areas of time. So the different levels sort of represent different time periods. So you've got one that's in Siberia, you've got one that comes on a bit later that's in the future, sort of on a UFO and stuff. And the game is really, each level's sort of like a little sub-game on its own, but it's great fun to play and I really enjoy playing it. It's a first-person game, so it's first-person perspective, and you basically just have to do various things, a bit like you would do in GoldenEye or any of the other sorts of games. You have to sort of activate a switch to open a door, sneak past some guards stealthily without being caught. But the big thing that I used to like, apart from the multiplayer aspect of the game, this is what I've been playing again recently. I've been playing Time Splitters again since I rescued my GameCube out of my parents' caravan.
Did it go like my Saturn did? Just refused to start and then goes, oh, like an old car, just started up again.
Well, actually, no, I was very lucky, because what I did with mine is I got it out of the caravan, and as any of you who've got caravans know, that caravans are sort of quite damp and sort of cold places. A bit like Glenn experienced, I think, when you got your Saturn out of the loft. And it was a bit mouldy and horrible, and I thought, oh, God, this is a bit nasty. So I actually pulled the whole thing into bits and I cleaned it all up. It looked all right on the inside. It had a bit of dust in it, obviously, because I played it a lot back in the day and I hadn't touched for about 6 years. And I cleaned it all up. And I got to tell you, when I did plug it in, the disc didn't spin round.
Oh, you had the same problem.
Well, no, not quite. My problem was more due to stupidity, actually, rather than it being broken, because the disc wouldn't spin. I thought, oh, no, this CD mechanism, you know, once the CD mechanism's broken, you might as well put it in the bin. And then I still had it apart when I was looking at it, and I noticed that actually one of the plugs that actually plugs the CD mechanism into the main console board actually wasn't plugged in properly. So I turned it all off and I took it out and I put it back in again and did it up, and it worked first time then. So it wasn't really broken, I just hadn't put it together quite right.
God, I tell you, I will never take my consoles apart and look inside them like that. I'd be scared I'd break them.
Well, it's okay. I mean, I've done a lot of this over the years, but there's sort of various videos online that you can sort of look at, because I got a little bit confused, I've got to be honest, with the GameCube, because I got to a point where it sort of came mostly apart. There's some bits that just wouldn't quite undo, and I was like, oh God, I don't know how to do this. So, you know, it felt like I was going to break it. So I went online, and unfortunately some guy who's very knowledgeable on YouTube had sort of taken the whole thing apart. It's literally just some screws that I thought were nothing to do with pulling it apart had to come out, and I took them out, it all fell apart beautifully. So Glenn, going back to SimCity, how would you rate that game today?
Well, I will actually give it about 3 out of 5 for today. And the main reason is because when SimCity 2000 came out, that was a big improvement.
Okay.
Then they brought out SimCity 3000. That was even better. Then they brought out the ultimate, SimCity 4. That is the best one ever. And I'm really doubting it in my head if the new SimCity could even beat that. That is simply the best SimCity ever.
So it really sounds like that through each different version, they've just added so much to it, and they've really improved it each time.
Well, I really do hope with this new SimCity, they put a realistic box engine and stuff in. I really hope they'll enlarge the map eventually. But that's a new game, so this is a retro podcast.
No, but it's always good to hear, you know, what's happening in the future, because, of course, you know, games of today are going to be the retro games of tomorrow. Now, with Time Splitters 2, I think it's really tricky, because I'm sort of struggling between giving it 8 out of 10 and 9 out of 10, because I really love it still, but I suppose in the context of today, it probably really needs about 8 out of 10. And the reason is, this multiplayer elements are really good, but you can't obviously network machines together to play it, which is obviously what people want to do now. And actually, that's, you can have even more players involved then. And having the 4 at the time sounded like a lot, but as soon as Quake came out, you could have like 10 or so players playing, if not more. It sort of added a whole new element to those sorts of games, but I still think it's an absolute classic, and it works well on all of the last generation console formats. So it works really well on PlayStation 2, Xbox, and on the GameCube. I've got a particular fondness for the GameCube version, it's one that I have, but I would definitely give it 8 out of 10, because it's got some fantastic sort of, the single player isn't so good, but the multiplayer is really good fun, and also it's got some single player challenges as well, which I'll just talk about very briefly. And in those challenges, what you can do is you can actually, you get given challenges like you have to, on one level, I think you're in a Chinese restaurant and you're armed with just a brick, and you basically have to break 60 or so windows within a very strict time limit. And at the end of the level, if you manage to do it in a good enough time limit, you get awarded a medal. You get a gold, bronze or a silver medal. And if you do very, very well, you get a platinum. So there's about 30 or 40 different challenges, and I've just been playing through them all again, and I've been trying to get my platinum medals for each challenge. I've got to say, I'm quite a long way off doing that yet, but it's great. It's brought back so many memories.
How do you find time to play these games, Damien? Because you basically you, Andy, everybody else, that you've got like families, jobs, mortgage, and even I can't find time to play a lot of these games.
I mean, to be honest, Glenn, what I do is I just sneak about, you know, 20 minutes to half an hour in here and there. And it's literally, this is why I don't play games like SimCity anymore, because it just takes too much time. And games like Time Splitters, I haven't really been playing the story modes because, again, you need a lot of time. But the challenges, they last for about 2 minutes. So you can pack in about five challenges in one evening and only be spending about 20 minutes, half an hour doing it. And that's basically how I do it. I just have to drop in and out a lot. And, you know, as Andy says as well, I do a lot of my retro gaming when I'm actually coming back from work. I go to London once a week on a Tuesday and I come back quite late. So I just sit on the train. It's about a 2.5 hour journey. So I just load up my laptop, load up an emulator, and I just play a few games on there. And that's really how I do most of my gaming nowadays.
Yeah, you see, I drive to work in the morning and my work's about a mile away from my house. So I can't say. I don't get that luxury.
No, I mean, that's the problem, really. I mean, I basically, most of the week, I work from home, so my office is actually about four steps away from my bed. So I don't get any retro gaming time there at all. But, you know, we all have loads of stuff going on always, and I just try and fit it in whenever I can. And I still love to have that diversion that playing games gives me, because, you know, real life can get really boring and really complicated and very stressful. And actually just playing a few games, you can get stressed in a completely different way.
Hello, this is Potty Boy, and you're listening to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, The Retro Asylum.
It's time for the next section now. And the next section is, it's the WTFs. Ooh, see, we've gone from some really good games like SimCity and Time Splitters, but now it's time to have a look at two games that we didn't like.
Yeah, this is right. So, you know, we've talked about games we really enjoy. Let's see what this week's WTF games are. Glenn, do you want to start and tell me what yours is?
Well, my WTF game is a game that was known to be the one of the most overhyped games ever. Ever. I remember seeing adverts in the paper saying, look at this graphics. These models are futuristic. The characters even are intelligent and know exactly where you jump in. And I only could be talking about one game now. Rise of the Robots.
Oh my god.
Oh, awful, awful game. I remember going into town when I was like, I was about 10 years old. And I saw the box art for this game. It looks like a futuristic 3D game. And I remember looking around the box thinking, God, that looks brilliant. It's a shame that I never actually looked at any reviews, because if I would have looked at one review, it would have been like, stay away, it's a trap. So I remember getting it home. The music in the game's good, and the graphics are good, but everything else is a load of dog poo. It's awful game. Have you ever played it?
Well, do you know what, Glenn? I have, and I can remember all the hype around it. I think they did, because it came out on various different formats. Now, I had an Amiga at the time, and I remember it came out on the Amiga. And I think Amiga Format Magazine, or it might have been CU Amiga, I can't remember which one, but I think they did some sort of behind the scenes, and they were saying, oh, the graphics are looking amazing. And in the months leading up to the game's release, they kept posting new things on, because all the graphics were pre-rendered, weren't they?
Yeah, they're all like pre-rendered graphics, so really when you think about it, it's not really fancy these days, isn't it?
No, that's right. And I mean, the 3D graphics were really back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, they were really taking off, and like lots of fads that come and go, things like 3D and stuff, everyone wanted in on the action. And Rise of Robots was an attempt to make a really, I mean, the game did look from the screenshots, looked absolutely amazing, didn't it? It looked like a proper arcade game. I thought, wow, my Amiga's going to become one of these really expensive arcade machines. They're going to do an amazing job. And of course, when it got released, it was really horrible, wasn't it?
It was a horrible game. And I believe on the Amiga version, there was like loads and loads of floppy disks for the game. So it took forever to load.
Yeah, I think so. I think because it had so many graphics and stuff, they'd obviously just gone mad and rendered all these 3D graphics. But yeah, it's a bit like Street Fighter 2 on the Amiga, which I think had four discs, and that's, oh god, that's a horrible, horrible game as well, and that probably deserves an entire WTF review all on its own.
Oh, the only redeeming feature of this game, like I said, was the music and the sound.
That was it.
that was it. It was horrible. I think I completed it in like about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And the AI on the enemies are so horrible. All you have to do is just kick. And they just crouch down into a corner. You just kick them and kick them. Then that's it.
Yeah, I remember playing this. It was one of those ones where, I mean, because some of the less clever fighting games that I've played in the past, especially some of the conversions haven't been done very well, you kind of just do what I call random joystick mashing, which is just where you just can move the joystick sort of roughly in the direction of the other player and just sort of hammer the fire button a lot, and you seem to win all the time. I think some of the conversions of Mortal Kombat on the Amiga were a little bit like that, just because they weren't converted very well. And it was sort of one of those ones you could just win, and I thought I was really good at these games, but then I actually got to play a really good fighting game like, you know, Street Fighter 2 on the SNES or something, where you have to do all the proper special moves and stuff. And I've got to tell you, Glenn, when I played those, I absolutely suck.
I'm never too good at those games either. Although, when I went down to the, I think it's dropping the Trocadero, I can't pronounce it.
And the Trocadero?
That's it. I did actually beat Malk.
Did you?
Yes.
Because he takes these very seriously. Because I remember, didn't we play Andy at... what were we playing Andy at? Was it Street Fighter 2 at Replay Expo last year?
Yeah, we did.
And he just won every time, and he was getting really, you know, really confident and cocky. None of us could beat him. It just got us more and more angry. So, Andy, watch out. This year, we're going to play you again, and we're going to beat you this time.
Yeah. Exactly, we're going to beat you, Andy.
Yeah, you're going to get yourself off your throne of Street Fighter 2, although he is very, very good at it.
So, what's your WTF game?
Well, my WTF game today is another fighting game. It's set in a slightly different time period. In fact, I don't really know what the time period is. I also, it's sort of the Egyptian era. Maybe it is the Egyptian era, I'm not sure. But it's a game that came out on the Spectrum and the Amstrad for sure. I think it might have come out on the Commodore 64 as well. And it's a game called Fighting Warrior. So I don't know if you've ever played that, Glenn.
Do you know, in the back of my head, what I remember, the graphics weren't that good. It looked like it moved very, very badly. And you fight one character on the screen, and behind, in the background, there's like pyramids and stuff. Is that the game?
That's absolutely right, Glenn. Yes, that's exactly the game. I mean, basically, I'm not too sure what the exact plot is, but you look like sort of Tutankhamun, who's sort of risen from the dead, and you're walking along this, well, very bland yellow path. And the idea is you walk along this path. I don't actually even know where you're supposed to be going to. You'll just go from the left of the screen to the right of the screen. It scrolls very jerkily along. And the idea is that as you walk along, you find various opponents to fight, and they're different creatures. Some look a bit lizard-like. The graphics actually themselves aren't too badly drawn, but the problem is on the Amstrad version, it's a bit of a Spectrum port. It's very monochrome, and the only bit of colour is, as you say, the pyramids at the top of the screen on the Amstrad.
Yeah, it looked a very bland game.
They were. There's absolutely, you've got literally a yellow black background where your main character is, and maybe the odd sort of little black stone that's drawn on the bottom of the screen, and that's about it. But at the top of the screen, they've sort of split the screen in two, and they've just drawn some pyramids in with a few colors, and that's basically the entire game graphics. And it's just so slow, because, you know, the Amstrad, when it did Spectrum ports, because where they were programmed, it could end up being really sluggish. And this, considering how little is happening on the screen, it's just horrible to play. And it's so, the worst thing about it, Glenn, it's just so boring.
Yeah, I noticed one thing about Amstrad games. Why do they always run bit slow?
Well, there's various reasons. When the Amstrad's programmed correctly, it won't happen, but the main reason they run really slowly is because, as you've probably heard a lot of Amstrad users sort of whining about, and especially back in the day, and even now, there's, if you go onto the CPC Wiki website, there's a whole section about this, and these were the dreaded Spectrum ports. And what it was is because the Amstrad and the Spectrum had the same CPU, and the Amstrad actually had the ability to program the graphics chip a bit. And what you could do is you could put the graphics chip in a mode where it had almost exactly the same sort of screen as the Spectrum. And that, of course, made it very, very easy just to copy a game across onto the Amstrad, make no changes to the graphics at all, and just copy the code over, and you've got an Amstrad game. Now, the problem with it is you can make it work, but you had to write some sort of conversion code that would convert the Spectrum graphics in real time to the Amstrad graphics system. Of course, that made it, that slowed it all down because of all that extra work going on. And this is why they were so sluggish quite often. And it was just simply because they wanted to get a game out on the Amstrad really, really quickly from the Spectrum, because the Amstrad user market wasn't quite as big. They didn't really, couldn't really be bothered, want to make a quick few bucks, so that's what they did.
It's a big shame that, because that tend to happen with the some of the Amiga and Atari ST games. Some of the Atari ST games were just simply ported to the Amiga, and the Amiga had a lot more graphical hardware, and it just didn't use it.
Oh, Glenn, yeah, that's one of the things that has really got to me at the time. And I remember really waiting for Outrun to come out on the Amiga, and I sort of played it on the Atari, and it's really choppy, and it's all right, but it's not very good. And I thought, oh wow, you know, when it comes out on the Amiga, it's going to be absolutely amazing. You'll be able to use the hardware scrolling, all the extra, and it didn't. It's the Atari version. I think it's actually a bit worse because the Amiga CPU is slightly slower. It's terrible. I just couldn't believe it, and funnily enough, I was playing it again on my Amiga 1200 the other day, just to remind myself how awful it was. I just played the arcade version on MAME, and I was like, oh, it's so smooth, the clouds look brilliant, the game is absolutely fantastic. I thought, oh, I wonder if the Amiga version really was that bad. I loaded it up, and my God, it is.
Yes.
It's a WTF all in its own right.
That is... I don't think, to me, it qualifies quite for a WTF, but it wasn't the greatest game on the Amiga. But at least on, like on the Commodore 64, is it because it had a different architecture? It had like a 6502 process, and it had hardware sprites, so you couldn't simply copy a Spectrum game over. Is that why they weren't always similar?
Yeah, I mean, that is probably pretty much the main reason, because the CPUs are different. But also, the Commodore ran a lot slower than the Amstrad or the Spectrum. So I think even if you had been able to write some sort of translation code, which you wouldn't have been able to, but even if you had, the Commodore would have been so slow, because the Commodore, Glenn, didn't really rely on its CPU at all. It didn't need to, because it had these hardware sprites and the hardware scrolling and the SID chip, all these wonderful chips that could actually run without the CPU doing any work at all. So really, the CPU on a Commodore did trivial things like keep the game score and maybe, you know, draw a new screen when you draw the background graphics for a screen, which you could do quite quickly. But really, it didn't really have to do much work at all. Whereas the Spectrum and the Amstrad, they had no hardware sprites, so
yeah,
they had to, all that had to be done by the CPU, and even synchronizing all the music again had to be done by the CPU. So it just made it a lot slower. But the CPUs ran a bit faster, so it kind of worked out okay. But it was the CPU type and the CPU speed that fortunately saved the Commodore from the dreaded Spectrum ports, and of course the fact that the Commodore had its hardware sprites plus a screen layout that really was just not compatible at all with the Spectrum or Amstrad CPC screen layouts.
Anyway, I think it's now time to round up the podcast now.
Yes, I think we will. I mean, guys, you know, we've had to do this really at the last minute, and so it is a little short podcast. We just wanted to get something out for you guys to listen to this week. Hopefully we're going to be back very shortly in full force with a proper show. And thank you for listening. Is there any shout outs you want to give, Glenn?
Well, I want to shout out to like Andy and Sweeney and Matt and Foggy and everybody who listened to us. And I want to apologise if this podcast seems a bit rushed and a bit unorganised, but the thing is that we all got our lives and sometimes life just gets in the way.
Yeah, that's right, Glenn. I mean, I would like to say thank you to all the guys who do the Retro Asylum podcast. Yeah, all the guys on the team. Really, really great. It's really fun working with you lot. And we, you know, I hope that all the listeners as well, who I want to thank you again, as Glenn, just for listening to the show and enjoying it and giving us so many really useful comments. And I did my first 8-bit wars on Monty on a Run literally a few weeks ago, and I've got to tell you, I had such a wonderful positive response in that video. And you know, it's the first time I'd done it. I felt a bit like a fish out of water. I hadn't done it before, and you know, I really wasn't sure how people were going to take it, but people have really enjoyed it. So, you know, even me rambling on about an old computer game, it seems to strike a chord with the listeners. So, you know, thank you guys. All your positive feedback is really, really well received. We love it. Makes us feel warm and fuzzy inside, and it makes us want to carry on and do this podcast show and do all the related videos and stuff. So again, thank you very much indeed.
And yeah, and we will see you next time, everybody.
We will. Take care, everybody. And to players out, I have a special remix of a classic Turrican soundtrack, The Desert Rocks by Chris Holzbeck. We'll be right back.
I didn't actually mean for you to hang up on me.
Well, yeah, that's how I tested it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I was already recording, so I was already hearing, and it sounded perfect, mate.
Cracking.
So, we'll, if you do your little intro, don't tell me what it is, and then we'll just get on with it.
Well, no, you always do the intro. The intro is always you.
No. I mean the readout line for the movie before we get into the intro.
You ready?
I was born ready, Phil.
I was waiting for that really bad movie quote. It's terrible. All right. Personally, I liked working for the university. They gave us money and facilities. We didn't have to produce anything. You've never been out of college. You don't know what it's like out there. I've worked in the private sector. They expect results.
You know what, Phil? I actually really think that was actually you talking there for a second. It sounded like you.
Well, yeah, it was me.
Oh, no, you know what I mean. You're talking about your life.
Yes.
Right, all right then. So let's get on with it. So 3, 2, 1. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Movie Asylum. This is episode 6. I'm your host, Andy Venkman, and joining me is the one, the only...
Phil Spengler.
Hey, how you doing, buddy? How are you?
I'm doing quite nicely. How's you today, then?
I am shattered beyond belief. I've just finished an early shift, and I'm jealous because someone I'm talking to at this moment in time has got 3 weeks off.
Who's that, then?
You, Phil.
Have I got a whole 3 weeks off? That's really nice for me, isn't it? Having so, 3 weeks off. Yeah.
So what are you going to be doing for these 3 weeks? Drinking? Sleeping?
Well, my first day up on Sunday, I woke up about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I actually got out of bed about 4 o'clock, so I really needed to pee and I would have stayed in bed for longer. Generally speaking, I haven't got much in the way of plans other than that. I do plan to go to the pub a few times here and there, you know how it is.
Yeah.
But it is just 3 weeks of no plans whatsoever, just 3 weeks of not having to go to work.
I know, that's the best thing. But what I would recommend though, Phil, is if you're going to go out drinking, do it in the first few weeks because you are getting on a bit and hangovers hurt a lot more as you get on a bit. So
no, I'm now that age where I stop drinking before I get hangovers.
Right, okay, wow. Wise man, wise man. So anyway, Phil, I haven't spoken to you or we haven't done a podcast in absolutely ages. It's been...
But no, you cancelled the last one. You were supposed to do this ages ago and you cancelled it for kind of important reason. You had some pathetic little pointless... Oh yeah, your daughter, you were seeing your daughter.
Yeah, you know, I should have just said to my daughter, I went, look, sorry, I can't pick you up today. I can't see you because I need to do a podcast.
Yeah, if she was a good daughter, she'd understand.
I'm sure she would. So what have you been up to since last time I saw you then? Anything exciting?
Exciting? No. I have managed to watch the cartoon versions of the Avengers and the Avengers 2 recently.
You enjoyed them?
They were quite good, actually. I was pleasantly surprised. I think I picked up a Marvel box set for about 6-7 quid or something, and there was two of the movies. They're different to the actual movies on the TV, or the cinema. But they're just so cheap, I just picked them up for laugh.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I've been up to them, buddy. I've been watching a few movies here and there, you know, just a little bit. I can't watch a whole movie because I'm doing shift work. It wears me out. So I watch about 30 minutes of a movie, go to sleep. The next day, continue on and so on. And
you mean you're an old man and you have naps whilst watching a movie?
I am, mate. That's exactly what I mean. Anyway, since I'm tired, why don't you sort of tell everyone what the film is we're going to talk about today?
Okay, as we mentioned at the end of our last podcast and on the website, we have decided upon Ghostbusters for this one. That's Ghostbusters 1, not Ghostbusters 2, because Ghostbusters 2 sucks and everything to do with it should be deleted from history.
I've got to disagree. Ghostbusters 2 is not bad.
Not bad if you have no taste. And so we'll discuss Ghostbusters and how we appreciate it and Andy's little crush on Bill Murray.
Bill Murray is my man crush, yeah.
Yes, and then that's about it. That's how we'll go, really. A bit like the last one.
Yeah.
Although, from what I believe, Ghostbusters isn't quite as perverted as Back to the Future was.
Hey, you don't know that. We still might find little innuendos or little things in there. Oh, before I carry on with this film, I want to quickly tell everyone that this podcast will be pretty much 99% unedited. And that's because I just can't be bothered to edit this podcast.
So you're lazy as well?
Well, I have got the Retro Asylum podcast, which is a weekly show, and that takes up all my time. So that takes about 6 hours, man. So,
oh, I noticed you were complaining on Twitter that you couldn't actually manage to do the whole thing at work. So you say it's taking up all your time whilst doing all the work at work, whilst you should be working.
No, that was on my lunch break, Phil. You know, there's me trying to go into the staff room, and then the next thing, I've got two cleaners that have sat down, and they've started braiding their hair and talking really loud.
You should have asked them to braid your hair.
I would have done, Phil, if I had, like, hair to braid. I would have done it, yeah.
You could braid your beard. You could be like Blackbeard the Pirate. He had braids in his beard, didn't he?
Yeah, I could do that. You know, sometimes I do grow my beard especially long. Anyway, we're not here to talk about braiding hair or braiding my beard. We're here to talk about the classic 1980s movie Ghostbusters. So why don't you tell us what that is all about then?
Well, I don't believe it was your turn to describe the movie, but okay, as you're obviously being in your lazy mood as usual.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters, three friends. You got Ray, Peter and Egon, who work at university. Their research is the best you could call it is paranormal experiences, but in reality it's just nothing. They get paid at university, they provide results, they just it's ridiculous.
Well, let's talk about, Phil, who these guys are played by.
As you've mentioned, you've got Bill Murray plays Dr. Peter Venkman, Bill Murray being your little man crush. Now he plays the womanizing, cheating, lying,
corruptible scientist.
Yes, you could buy a second-hand car from him and it wouldn't get you to the end of the road.
Yeah.
Then you've got Dan Aykroyd, who plays Dr. Ray Stantz.
Yep.
He's the honest, gullible, he believes very heartily with all his heart and everything.
Yeah, the way I describe him, Phil, is, I mean, he's like the big kid of the group. He's got that very childlike sort of like awe and everything. He's got that enthusiasm as well.
I'll go childlike enthusiasm and gullibility and naivety.
Yeah.
And then you've got the third one is Harold Ramis. Ramis, who plays Dr. Egon Spengler. He's my favourite character, personally. And he's the truly, truly insane, eccentric scientist. And he has very few personal skills, and it's just all about the science.
Yeah, he reminds me of you, Phil.
Pure knowledge is what you could probably describe him best at. It's just like, yeah, he's in a field that's not very well respected.
Right, so, yeah, carry on telling us then, because I think, if memory serves me right, the original scene of the film starts off in the university library.
Yes, it's with Dr. Peter Venkman being a pervert.
Before that...
I thought that was the first scene with him and the two students.
No, no, that's where it kicks off after the title credits. In the beginning...
Oh, yes.
University library.
Yes, yes.
This old librarian woman, and she's wheeling the book things along, and then you know something's going to happen because the music's getting a little bit creepy, and then things start to sort of move, and the books start flying out.
And then you've got the jaws opening of all the little index cards. The index cards start flying everywhere.
Yeah.
And then there's this really... I always thought at the time it was a really scary ghost she comes upon. Mm. And when that ghost screams and the poor little old librarian runs out of the room, it's actually quite a scary ghost. And considering how old would I have been when I saw this, I suppose this was 1984. Mm. So I'd have been 2-ish, maybe 10. Yeah. No, I thought I was 10, but maybe for a few younger children. I'm thinking, because this is a PG, yeah. it was a scary ghost.
Well, you know the ghost that they encounter in the library?
Yes.
The one that you don't get to see till a little bit later on. I think her name's the White Lady. To find out more about her, what I would say is, guys, play the Xbox 360 game or the PS3 game, because it gives you detailed history of all the ghosts in that film. But anyway, then the title credits kick in with that classic soundtrack by Ray Parker Jr.
Which I assume you will put a little bit of it on this podcast when you do at least your 1% of editing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think the only editing I'm doing is just adding the music in, and that's about it.
That was just me having a dig at your lack of work, by the way.
Okay. You could try editing.
And then we start meeting the actual characters, the cast. We meet Bill Murray. He's doing a very unethical, dubious test on two students, one really hot girl and one geeky guy. He's trying to see if they can read his mind, and he's cheating, mad, flirting with a girl trying to get her into bed whilst having fun electrocuting a poor sod.
Yeah.
But then it turns out they all get fired from the university because, well, they're crap. Then they get called off to go to the library. The librarian and Egon's there already. And then that's when they start meeting ghosts. You get ghosts from then onwards.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you've actually ever read the novelisation of the film.
There's a book. There's a serious book on Ghostbusters.
Yeah, there's a book of Ghostbusters. I've got it. It's probably one of my favourite books. And basically, even though he is Dr. Peter Venkman, let's just say Ray and Egon had a big part on actually helping him get through his tests and exams.
Yeah, so I can see he would have happily bought the answers from them and paid them. He's that type of person. He'll be too drunk or too busy doing other things to actually go to the exams and send someone in his place quite happily.
But he's such a likeable character, and to me, that is the ultimate Bill Murray role. Now, Bill Murray normally plays Bill Murray in every single film, but this is when he's at his best of any film.
Oh, but there is one person who doesn't like him. There's one person who doesn't like him. Later on in the film, Walter Peck, the environmentalist, doesn't like Bill Murray at all.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about Walter Peck a little bit later on. So, yeah they get fired. That's when they decide to set up this business by actually putting out a second mortgage on Ray's house.
Second mortgage? It's not a second mortgage. It's the third mortgage.
Oh, the third mortgage.
Yeah, it's like they're walking out of the bank and there's Ray saying, "My parents left me their house. I was born there." And Peter just says, "You're not going to lose the house. Everyone has three mortgages nowadays." It's like three mortgages. And that was back in the 80s. Could you imagine what that'd be like now? I think Egon actually works out the interest payments on the mortgage for like 1 month or something.
Yeah,
$90,000 or something stupid.
Wow,
poor guy's gonna be skint. And they do buy the coolest X fire station. I think I'd be like Ray, where you see that pole in the middle of the fire station, you can slide down that pole.
Yeah.
Just to go down, rather than using stairs. If I had a choice, I live in a second floor flat. If I had a choice, if I had a fireman's pole to slide down on my way out to work or something, I'd go down to work slightly happier.
It's true. You'd have to look forward to that every morning. But you know, the actual fire station, it's not a set. It's actually a place in New York, basically. It's famous. People actually walk past it and take pictures of it. It's really a fire station.
I can believe it's a fire station. It'd be easier just to buy an old fire station probably than make one, wouldn't it? But then they buy the car, and I love that car, but it's an old hearse, painted white, the flashing lights on the top, and the Ghostbusters symbol on the side. And who are you going to call? Ghostbusters!
And that car was Ecto-1, that's the number plate of the hearse.
I can't decide what I like best, the car or the building. Both are really cool.
Now, it's around this time, I think, where the story sort of starts moving on to the other character, which was played by Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, yes.
The character Dana Barrett.
She's a very sensible, straight-laced lady who plays in a classical orchestra. She comes home and you hear the background music. You know something's going to happen. You're not sure what it is.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, eggs start jumping out of her shopping and frying on her work surface, and she opens the fridge. She sees the light and she opens the fridge and it's Zool, and she runs away screaming.
That sounded terrifying, Phil. If I opened up my fridge and you were in there and you said Zool like that, I'd
be a bit cold. But this is a woman who's fought aliens several times and defeated them, and she's scared of a fridge, a speaking fridge. Oh, wow.
You know what?
That'd be a cool gadget. Opening, you could get a little gadget where you can program it to say certain things.
You know what? I think I'm going to create that for fridges. You open up and it goes, Zool.
You can program it to say anything. So you can help dieters saying, close the door, you fat b-. Because you just have a quite cool Ghostbusters version, couldn't you? But anyway, yeah. So Sigourney Weaver, the character's name is Dana. She turns up. She's their first client, and it was... And Peter Venkman's all over her, drooling and wanting to seduce her.
Yeah.
And goes back to her place, and not much happens there. He flirts with her. He wants to try and ask her out, and she's a bit too classy for it. And He goes to her apartment and doesn't find anything. Finds a fridge full of bad food, junk food and stuff, which he swears wasn't hers. And
but the whole time though, Phil, is when he enters that apartment of hers and he's got that little gizmo, and he's just like squishing it, and she's just looking at it, and she's like, "You don't act like a scientist."
Yes, and he really is just playing such a atrocious character. He's just like, he's not someone you'd have any confidence in whatsoever.
Well, she basically, you know, he starts looking around and then he heads towards the bedroom and she goes, "Oh, that's the bedroom, nothing happened in there." And he's like, "Oh, that's a crime."
Yes. And then he starts playing on the piano, just two fingers to try and play. And it's just like, he's really, really not a professional scientist.
Yeah.
So he finds nothing anyway, and then we get the first proper bit of ghost busting.
Before we go into that, Phil, let me quickly just tell one thing. There is another character there that does get introduced before all that, which was Rick Moranis' character.
Yes.
What was it? Lois Tully.
Yes. I liked him. Whilst I want to try and be Egon, I've got a feeling I'm more like Lois Tully myself.
He's just like a geeky next-door neighbour.
He plays the same character. Rick Moranis has never played anything apart from the geeky accountant type person.
But what made this amazingly funny was that because he runs out to her and he's like, oh, you know, that she had left the TV on so loud and the landlord or people started complaining, so he turned his TV on really loud so everyone would think that, you know, the TV system had gone wrong. But what is funny about that, he's wearing a little tracksuit top, you know.
Oh, yes.
See, apparently he'd been working out and he did the whole cycling thing, you know, in double time just so he could get an extra workout.
He's a very geeky accountant, really.
Yeah. But anyway, go on, Phil. You're saying they get their first real call, and that's when Janine says... No, was it that one?
Yeah, yeah, Janine gets... we've got one. Hits the big buzzer on the desk, and the buzzer goes off, and they all start sliding down the pole and getting in their uniforms. You get the car going through the city with the blaring siren. I don't know what the... siren is, because it's not a normal police siren, is it? It's a different siren they've got there. It's a Ghostbusters siren, but it's not the normal siren, at least not one you hear nowadays.
Yeah.
And they go to a really nice hotel, really, isn't it?
It's a hotel.
Hotel.
Yes. 5-star hotel.
Yes. And that's where we meet. They get told they get turned up, and they're all supposed to be like low key, and they're so not. And then they decide to split up, and that's when we first meet Slimer, who is one of the reasons why Ghostbusters 2 sucks so much.
Right. Now, before you we go into that, you know, Bill Murray wasn't originally meant to be Peter Venkman.
Who was?
It was actually John Belushi. Yeah, John Belushi was originally meant to be Peter Venkman. But unfortunately, you know, and sadly, he had passed away, so he couldn't obviously play the role.
Well, no, being dead.
Yeah, but what they did do, because these guys were all friends and they worked on Saturday Night Live, they thought they would base the ghost on, you know, James Belushi, which is who Slimer is basically based on.
Oh, okay.
That's why he's drinking, you know, and eating
and he's a pig. He's a greedy little pig. However, if I was John Belushi, I would not want Slimer to be people to say Slimer's based on me.
Sorry, did I say John Belushi or James Belushi?
I don't know. It's John Belushi anyway.
It's one of the Belushi brothers anyway. Right, and that's basically, they start going up in the lift, and they've got that amazing scene where the guy goes, "Are you some guy, you know, some sort of exterminators?"
Oh, yeah, it's big cockroaches.
And he's like, "Yeah, someone spotted a big cockroach." And the guy goes, "Must be some sort of big cockroach." And he goes, "Yeah, it'll bite your head off, man."
Yeah. But I just like the fact that they get to destroy most of the place. They've got the nuclear charging packs on their back.
I tell you what, as a kid though, Phil, didn't you want one of those?
Yes, as a kid.
The proton packs. You still want one?
Oh, if one turned up somewhere, I wouldn't say no to it.
Yeah, you know. But I tell you what, one of my favourite scenes before they actually catch Slimer and cause of the chaos is when they first get out the lift and Egon's got his PKE meter. And they're following it.
Or the little bits flash, go move up at the front of it and flash the way a proper scientific tool should do. It moves and flashes green lights.
Yeah, but you know, it was that poor old cleaner. She's pushing that trolley along. And they actually shoot the trolley.
Yes. And bits of fire, bits of it catch fire and stuff like that.
Yeah, so anyway, what actually happens, they split up. And does Peter get slimed before they... Yeah, obviously Peter gets slimed first of all, doesn't he?
Yes, he's slimed, yes.
Yeah, he goes, he's looking at me, and it stares at him, and then it starts going forward, and you see Bill Murray's face, he's getting a bit scared, and then you hear him screaming.
It's quite a special effect, considering this was 1984, and then Slimer goes straight through him and through the wall.
It's fantastic special effects. I think it's, all the effects have aged really, really well.
Yes, they have.
It's got like a cartoony type feel to it. It's not. I wouldn't say it's realistic. Everything is
ghost
cartoon. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it tries to be too. I don't know.
I think realistic. That. I think graphic-wise, they probably got away with it. They made it luminous green, which probably helped cover up the fact that it was graphics. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There's no line around the edges and stuff like that. But after poor Peter gets slimed and Egon's all happy that he got slimed, it's like the first time there's been physical contact and everything like that, and takes us on.
Yeah.
They go downstairs to the really nice
ballroom.
Ballroom, massive chandelier, beautiful tables all laid out for a big party that's going to be coming in. And the poor hotel man's really nervous and doesn't want him to destroy it or cause any damage. Which, obviously, you know the moment he says that, they're just going to burn the place to the ground almost, which they do. And all three of them go into the ballroom, and that's when they start. That's where you know not to cross the beams.
Yeah, which, the streams, they call
stream,
them, yeah.
Yes, don't cross the streams, which is a very repeated comment to the school playground when I was 10. I'm sure lots of boys said that type of thing. That's this movie.
Yeah. Now, that's when they first catch their first ghost.
Yes.
And I thought it was an amazing the way they did it. You know, it was a real struggle to capture him. And the way the streams work is they sort of shoot out. You can sort of make them longer, shorter. And then once you've captured him, I think you sort of like they shorten it and pull it down and aim it towards a trap. Once that trap is sort of ready, they press it and out
shoots. The light beam shoots up and drags them, pulls the ghost in.
That was phenomenal. And from there, I think it moves on to little scenes where it's them sort of like becoming like little mini celebs because they're going out catching loads of different ghosts, you know, becoming on the TV, you know.
Yes. It was definitely done very, very beautiful.
Right. So what happens from there then, Phil? Go on.
What happens after that? They go back and then they start. You kind of get a little bit of a timeline going where they start to become a bit more successful. You don't see the whole thing. You see them going out and rushing around working. Getting more ghosts as things happen, and then Egon goes back to Sigourney Weaver's character Dana,
yeah,
because Egon finds out a little bit more history about the building she lives in, which as the movie goes on becomes very important. It was created by a cult, and they made out of a special.
I think it's Igor Shandor.
Yeah.
Now, Igor Shandor was the architect, and in the game and in the book, basically, he designed that to be like a satellite. Yeah. He created that to draw evil forces from the other side, basically.
And it was made with different materials that shouldn't be used, and it was all designed, to be a focus point, wasn't it? And you find out this story as it goes along, as they're rushing around, as the boys are rushing around collecting ghosts, you see a little bit of that, and you see Peter flirting with Dana again.
Yeah.
And then you're going to get a bit of that for the middle of the movie, and that's where we meet Winston, the fourth member of the Ghostbusters team. They're all really overworked. Starts off with them having no work. By this time, they're all really overworked. Winston applies for a job. And during the application, they just hire him. They're all knackered. You can see they're just all falling apart. And they show you a little bit more about the place they work in.
So how they contain the containment system.
Containment system. That's how they introduce Winston. They say stick it in here, pull the lever, and so on.
Yeah, and that's pretty much how they trained him up. Just
that was his training. Yes, that was your entire training.
Now again, going back to the book a little bit, Phil. Did you know Winston Zeddemore? In the book, he's had some sort of like military army sort of type training.
That's quite common in America, I would have thought. But No, I didn't know that. I don't really understand how that would be particularly relevant to ghostbusting.
Well, I think, you know, the reason why they've got Winston in there, he's like the viewer, he's like the normal person around these crazy characters, because there's only a few realistic characters when you think about it in the movie. You've got Dana, she plays it very straight, and yes. Then I think Walter Peck as well.
I personally liked the receptionist. I think Janine was pretty realistic for a very, very bored receptionist not wanting to work and having a pointless job, although she did fancy Egon. She was quite obsessed with poor Egon, who was oblivious to it.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what happens next. There's a scene where Lois Tully's having a party for all his accountants.
Yeah, after that middle bit, it all kind of moves on to moving the storyline forward very, very fast, isn't it? It's just like, after that point, everything happens in one. His timeline is literally one night, really, isn't it? It's just from that point where he has his party, everything kind of goes on.
And I'll tell you what, that's one hell of a party, because that's a scene that really scared the crap out of me, Phil.
What, the accountant's party? That's scary.
No, not that party. But I mean, one of the visitors that was at the party, which was that terror dog.
Yes. Those dogs were quite cool.
Yeah, because it was like a gargoyle-type creature, and it sort of like entered his room, and it started chasing him, and it chases him down the stairs, and he's running, screaming for help.
And no one helps him because it's New York City.
Exactly, yeah.
And the dog finally captures him. And same thing's happening to Dana, the other dog, the other gargoyle dog. She's sitting down in her living room, and the dog's hands just shoot out of the sofa and grab her. And the chair just moves forward to this door that opens, and it's bright light, and she just pulls her into it.
And this is like a little interesting bit. I didn't really notice this. Maybe I was a bit too innocent, Phil. But she became the gatekeeper.
Yes.
And he became the keymaster.
Well, yes, because when Peter turns up in a while to talk to her, to ask her out on a date or something, she opens the door wearing a very silky-like dress, silk dress with a bit of wind blowing, looking very sumptuous. And all she says is, "Are you the gatekeeper?" And he says no, so she shuts the door.
No, are you the keymaster?
Keymaster, yes. Are you the keymaster? And she says no, so he shuts the door.
Yeah.
And then he knocks again, says yeah. He bluffs his... He does his car salesman routine and bluffs his way in, saying his mate's the keymaster, and he told him to come round. And Dana then just like tries to interact with him in a physical manner.
Yeah.
And then she starts, she lies down in the bed, and she kind of does that magic trick where she floats upwards and just hovers a few, 4 feet above the bed. And that's where Peter finally realises something's wrong.
It takes them that long to realise something's that wrong.
Yes.
But yeah, during all this though, they've had problems with Walter Peck. Walter Peck thinks that the Ghostbusters are frauds.
Yes.
He really believes there's that they're going to cause some big problem, and he's such an idiot. He really is. Walter Peck's so annoying.
And he's supposed to be, isn't he? Yeah, he plays the annoying... Yeah, he's a pain in the neck, but he plays it quite well. And he turns up with the police and city worker with the court order saying to turn off the containment field. And all that, saying, don't turn it off, nasty things will happen, blah, blah, blah. And he's saying, turn it off. And it gets turned off, and you see the nice light show. This is another good bit of special effects. They didn't overcomplicate the special effects for it, did they? They just did beams of light shooting out through the top of the roof of the fire station. You saw the occasional ghost flying out and about. You saw the ghost going out, sucking itself up the exhaust pipe of the taxi. Yeah. And then the passenger coming in, and you see what can only be, I would describe as a zombie, but obviously a ghost, and just drives this poor guy off, swerving and crashing into everything.
And that was a sign that the keymaster was looking for, and the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
So basically, he follows that, and that's what basically directs the keymaster. I think, what was the keymaster's name? Vince Clothos, I think.
The keymaster was Lewis.
No,
Lewis.
But I think the original, the Keymaster's actually got a name, which is Vince Clothos.
Oh, that's not in the film. That must be in the book.
No, it is in the film because
is it?
There's a scene beforehand where Egon was doing tests on him, and he was like, "Who are you?" And he goes, "I'm Vince Clothos, the Keymaster of whatever else." And that's before they lose him. You know, that was all before Walter Peck came along. But anyway,
the evil Walter Peck, yes.
Yeah. So the Keymaster. This is the bit I was saying I was innocent. Obviously, he enters the gates, which basically opens the door for Zool.
Yes. And then the poor Ghostbusters, they're in prison by this stage because Walter Peck's got them all arrested. And Egon somehow has a very large blueprint plan of the entire building Dinah lives in whilst in prison. And they're laying a towel across the table in the holding cell.
Yeah.
And they're talking about how this is where you find out about the architect who designed it. They're talking about who designed it and how he designed this and the metals he used. So it was and the cult and all that lot, and how it's going to be quite simply the end of the world and all that type of stuff. Blah blah blah. The prisoners start to look a little bit worried. You know how it is, but then the governor is it the not the governor? Is it the mayor of New York?
The mayor of New York.
He calls them. He summons them out from the police from the prison, and they go into his office, having a little bit of an argument. Well, it's not really an argument with Walter Peck again. It's more Peter Bateman just takes the piss out of him.
He goes, this man has no penis.
He has no penis. Yes, and it's just like that's the way he deals with it. Just uses his humour to deal with Walter Peck.
Yeah.
But the mayor, with a bit of advice from a bishop and the police officer and all that lot, does finally take their advice of trying to save the lives of millions of registered voters, yeah. And gives the Ghostbusters freedom and permission to go after the guy.
So yeah.
They drive off. You see all the worried people being held back by the police around surrounding.
Yeah.
Thing. Personally, I thought if a building's falling apart and about to fall down, it'll be attacked by ghosts or whatever, I wouldn't stand outside it. You see see different religious groups all praying, got the nuns praying, the Jews praying, got everyone praying, and
yeah.
And then the Ghostbusters in their vehicle, that siren going, everyone starts cheering.
Yeah.
And then the ground, it's like a mini earthquake almost. The ground starts shaking.
I thought you were going to forget about that.
Bits of the building fall down. But, I don't know how they did that. It must have been a model, I reckon, to do the whole ground literally moves enough the vehicle disappears into the ground, the boys all get vanished into it, and it's all the crowd finally get back up, and they're all worried that the Ghostbusters has been killed before the whole thing started.
Yeah.
And as they crawl out, the crowd start cheering and clapping. You get the first bit of happiness, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then the boys, they have to go and climb. I don't know how many stores and how many floors it is now. It's a big
skyscraper.
It's an American-style skyscraper, and there's no lifts because obviously there's no power.
And don't forget they're carrying the proton packs, which weigh God knows how much.
And he wants to, when he gets to the 20th floor, let me know so I can throw up. So it's just like, anyway, it's got to be about 47th floor. I don't know, that number rings a bell. That could be Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's lots of stairs.
Me and you couldn't go up those stairs, Phil.
I could, but I need a lift. Those lifts on the stairs for old people.
Yeah, stair lift,
yeah. But so once they've got up all these stairs, they're not actually that out of breath, but they're supposed to be a little bit more knackered than they are. They go into Dinah's apartment just to find the glowing door remains. It's like, where those stairs go? It's another flight of stairs. It shouldn't really be there because bear in mind, it's an apartment. And so I just go up these stairs, and that's where we see the outside of the building. I suppose it's across between the two realms because there's no way that outside of the building is outside of the building.
Yeah.
And you see the two gargoyle dogs that they don't know, but we do. We don't actually know. No, we don't know they're Dinah and Lewis either, do we? You can probably have a guess. I think maybe
they got possessed by them.
Yeah, they are possessed by them, but you don't know for sure. But I think as an adult, you look back at it, you know it is them.
Yeah.
And they take up guarding positions, and then Zool, who's actually, I looked up one, she's some Russian dancer, ballerina.
Yeah.
She features almost nothing. Her acting life has almost disappeared after that. She did tiny little bits in other movies, but she had a very nice body. But she was a dancer, I think.
Yeah, she looked kind of scary, though, because her eyes were kind of creepy as well.
Yeah, glowing eyes and the spiky hair and...
Yeah, that's when she asked them, she goes, "Are you a god?"
And Ray says, what? "No." "Then die." And then all this lightning bolts come out of her fingers, and you see the boys being thrown back, and you get a different scene where you're looking for the people down below, and they see all the lightning bolts flying out above their heads, above the ground and all that lot. And then Bateman, Winston gets a nice line, "Ray, when someone asks if you're a god, you say yes." I think that's probably Ray's best line in the whole film, really.
Oh, definitely. But that's when basically they decide to try and shoot up. I don't think nothing happens.
Yeah, they shoot the first time. It goes through her or something. It disappears. And then she does a nice little massive leap and jumps around the place a little bit.
And that's when she just says, "Choose your destructor."
Yes.
And the way you choose is by thinking. So they all try and sort of like clear the thoughts. But yeah, before we find that, we tell everyone, obviously everyone knows, what would have you created, Phil?
Mine would have been probably, what's that movie, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman? It would have been something like that.
It would have been Daryl Hannah.
Not Daryl, I suppose back of that era would have been after watching things like, what's the one where she's a splash? Things like where she's the mother, isn't there? It probably would have been.
Is that what you would have thought? You would have thought of like a giant half-naked woman?
Yeah. Wouldn't you?
No, I probably would have thought...
I was tense. Oh, I probably wouldn't have just thought too naked.
I don't know if you've ever seen her on YouTube. It's this girl. Her name is Miss Hannah Minx. That's who I would have thought of. She's like this really attractive, big boob. Apparently she teaches Japanese on YouTube, but that's who I would have imagined. But anyway, going off subject there, Ray dreams up the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
No, I've never known. Is he actually some image in America? Is he some brand name or something in America? Or was he just completely created for the movie?
I think they created something for him. There must have been things similar to him. And so they created a brand for him, I believe. Maybe some of our American listeners can let us know. But I think it was just created for the movie. You know, I think
that's the way I thought of it too. But I wasn't 100% sure, because obviously it could be an American thing that I just don't know about.
Yeah, so anyway, that's when you start hearing like the thunderous steps, and you know it's going to be something huge, and you can hear people screaming, and then all of a sudden from the side of a building you can see what looks like a bit of a sailor hat.
Yes, it's a big marshmallow. I thought he looked more like who's the big tie guy there, the one who advertises tires from the 80s?
Yeah, I know the one you mean, Michelin Man,
yeah. He just looked like a really big like version of that, and he's big enough to be the same size as the building they're in almost. And
don't you think, Phil, though, it's amazing that special effects when he starts walking in between the buildings.
So they shoot him, bits of him start catching fire, and he starts climbing a building, and all this flaming marshmallow shoots up, and the boys have to fall back and run back because of the flames and stuff. It was a very, very, very well done. Even I watched it a while ago, and even now, the special effects for that, the marshmallow, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man climbing a building, still looks very, very well done.
Yeah, it is phenomenal, Phil. Again, to recreate this, what I would say is get the PS3 game, Phil. I'm sure you can pick it up really dirt cheap. It's got all the elements from the first film and the second film, and it gives you a backstory and creates a new story at the same time. It's phenomenal. So, yeah. How do they kill the Marshmallow Man then?
Well, Egon has a radical idea. The door swings both ways. We can always reverse the particle flow through the gate. This is... Right. Peter says, how? Egon, we'll cross the streams? Excuse me, Egon? You said crossing the streams is bad. You can endanger us, you can endanger our clients, the nice lady who paid us in advance, before she became a dog.
Oh, God.
But yes, and so they start shooting the beams, they start crossing the beams, big bang explosion, it works. nicely.
It does. And it gets rid of everyone, kills everyone.
The Marshmallow Man, the Marshmallow Puff Man explodes, and everyone, the boys are covered in marshmallow, down below on the street, lumps of marshmallow are falling, and
Walter Peg
gets splattered with a really large, massive pile of fried marshmallow, which I think everyone, even the kid, and it's, I was 10, so the kid in me would have loved it, but even now it's entertaining to see him being splattered by a massive lump of that.
So Peter starts worrying that Dana's dead, and it's all sort of like sad music, and then, you know, she comes out.
A hand breaks free from the statue, and they realise they all rush over to free her, and then they remember to go and fight the little guy as well, Lewis.
Yeah. And, you know, it turns out they saved the day, and everyone's happy and celebrating.
And the crowd downstairs are all happy and cheering. And it's all, the good music is playing as they come out of the building, and everyone is really happy, and there's a big parade, but, you know, considering how the building should be falling apart and marshmallow falling over everything, they're all remarkably happy and cheerful, and crowds are cheering their names, and it's, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters!
But you forgot one more thing, though. Slimer escapes right at the end, heading towards the screen.
Does he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what? I mentally blocked out Slimer. I don't know.
Yeah. But it's a great
film. I was 10, and I didn't like Slimer.
Ever. It's probably up there with me with Back to the Future. I think films in the 80s are just fantastic.
Well, they're just our generation, from our childhood. If you're a child, I'm sure if you're a 12-year-old girl, I'm sure you'd like Twilight as well. But
no,
it's just not aimed at us, is it? So,
yeah, I don't know. Twilight.
No, you've got to be a 12-year-old girl to enjoy Twilight.
I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, that was Ghostbusters, one of my favourite films, Phil. Last section we're going to move on to now is the three-word reviews and listener feedback on the film. So basically, to give you an idea of what I mean, my three-word review for this was, "He slimed me," which is a famous thing that, you know, Bill Murray said. So the first one is from Jack O'Lantern, and his three-word review is Ray Parker Jr.
I'm not even going to show my ignorance by asking who that is, because I now know, because you just told me.
Right, yeah, during the bit I'm going to edit out, Phil said, "Who's Ray Parker Jr.?"
Okay, so well, I'm not knowledgeable about music for movies. Hey. Shoot.
Right, so anyway, read out our next three-word review.
We've got next one from Dick Dugler.
Yeah.
"Spores, molds, and fungus."
Love that. That was the line that Egon says when Janine asked him, "So what hobbies do you have?" All right, let me read out the next three-word review, and that is "Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man."
He was a great bad guy. You got to admit, as a bad guy goes, that's something people just would not think about. You just would not imagine a bad guy of being a 60-foot-tall marshmallow man. Hi, Sweeney. We got one! That was from Janine, wasn't it?
Yep, that's it.
I won't even take the mickey out of Sweeney having done a quote from a receptionist. two women in the entire film, and he chooses one of them to quote.
Well, I think all in all, I think everyone absolutely loves that film. Now, what we're also going to do with the movie Asylum as well, I put out a poll, Phil, and the poll was, I gave people some choices of what films they wanted to watch. What films they wanted us to talk about for the next movie Asylum.
Yes.
Now, the choices were Goonies, Jaws, The Lost Boys, and Die Hard.
Well, I know that I'm always going to vote for The Lost Boys.
Yeah, I voted for The Lost Boys. Now, let me tell you what got Jaws got 0%. Die Hard got 0%. The Lost Boys got 25%.
Wow, and it's the Goonies. 75%
was the Goonies, yeah.
Haven't done the Goonies, haven't read the Goonies for ages. That's going to be weird. I'm going to have to dig that out from somewhere.
Right, so guys, again, I will put something up on the forum that says Goonies, and once again, please give us your three-word reviews for the film Goonies, and me and Phil will read them out.
So, yes, yeah. it's going to be some serious effort to try and find a copy of that. I honestly haven't read The Goonies for a... watched The Goonies for a long, long time.
I'll tell you what, you need to see that film because it's got Sean Astin before he became a Hobbit. And he was also the nephew of Gomez from the Addams Family. And I'll tell you what, let's save all this Goonies talk for the next episode of the Movie Asylum. Any thank yous or goodbyes you'd like to say, Phil?
No, I'm just happy to say goodbye to the world. I'll enjoy my 3 weeks of annual leave whilst you're at work.
Yeah, damn you, Phil. Damn you, Phil. So, yeah, I'm going to shoot off, and I'll see you guys next time with more episodes of the Retro Asylum and at some point later with the Movie Asylum.
Yes.
See you guys next time.
See you guys.
Bye.
Bye. I ain't afraid.